Well, hello everyone. Today I'm going to be reading a chapter on what the world wars destroyed in Europe from a book called The Character of Peoples by Andre Siegfried. He was a guy who was around in the 1940s. He was a Democrat around the time of Vichy France and thereafter. And I saw this book recently. I read a different book by Biggs, if you remember, a couple of weeks back, and I saw Siegfried was mentioned in the footnotes. And I thought, well, that sounds like an interesting book. I think I'll pick it up. And I've decided that this book looks interesting enough that we're going to do a whole series on this, because he asked the question, do the people in nations, such as in France, England, Germany, Russia, America, and so on, have a national character? Okay. Can we generalize on that sort of level, or is it just for the birds? And this is a really interesting question, and also quite fun as well, dealing with national stereotypes and so on. I was just really interested to see what this French writer writing in the mid-century had to say about it. But the opening chapter here, the new face of the world, is actually Siegfried writing. I think this book was written 1952, just after World War II, talking about how the face of Europe and the face of European life and attitudes and values and so on was changed forever by the two world wars. And for the remainder of this video, I'm going to be reading this chapter to set us up. And then hopefully in the forthcoming weeks, we've got another 7 weeks on this book. I'll go through every chapter. The reason I'm doing this is because this book is exceptionally hard to get hold of. And just as I did with Britain's Blunder, if you remember, I read all the way through that. I try to make these things available, at least for those who are interested. So I'm going to start. Just before I get going, if you want to improve your own writing, pick up the Trivium, your critical thinking skills, logic, your rhetoric, and so on, pick up the Trivium today, and many other great courses at the academic agency. Now, let's make a start. The face of the new world. In the psychology of all peoples, there is a certain permanent basis which makes itself constantly felt. In many of our traits, we French still resemble the Gauls, who are our ancestors, and the characteristics of Tacitus, noted in the barbarians and the Jews of his day, are still visible in the Germans and the Jews of our day. But, of course, there have been modifications. In the following pages, we propose to ask ourselves what this solid basis of the Occidental peoples really consists of, and to what extent these peoples are in a position to adapt themselves to the revolutionary conditions in which they have to live today. In the 30 years, two wars, and what wars, have changed the face of the world and upset its equilibrium. We have come to realize that it is no question of simple evolution, but of revolution in the exact and ruthless sense of the term. Nothing is any longer in its familiar place. The value of things is no longer the same. The very relations between men have been turned upside down. The conceptions that men held of the universe and of its laws have been subjected to such violent changes that the very basis of morality in the ways of thought have been shaken. Of course, the crisis had been fermenting for a long time before it had come to a head. The profound consequences of the Industrial Revolution were already making themselves felt at the end of the 19th century. The machine had invaded all spheres and affected all things, breaking down the divisions of a society which strongly still held under the influence of an earlier age. We should realize that the two wars were not in themselves causes. They were merely accelerated, though to a fantastic degree, a fundamental tendency which would probably have arisen in any case. We are, in fact, facing something quite new, something for which there was nothing or almost nothing in the past to prepare us. When we look around us today with anxiety, but not without curiosity, we experience something like the awed astonishment of a man leaving his refuge after the bombardment and wondering how much he will find still standing of the surroundings which were once so familiar to him. And in fact, the world which now surrounds us is geographically new to us. Today, it is more extra-European than European. Its centre of gravity has shifted. Gradually, we have come to realise at last that we are living in the 20th century, and it has taken us many years to accustom ourselves, one might almost say to resign ourselves, to it. Its character now appears to us in striking contrast with that of its predecessor, the stupid but perhaps regretted 19th century. It is a remarkable thing that the catastrophes we have suffered have taught the old world a pessimism which was not natural to it. Our fathers, and we too in our youth, believe with unshakable faith in progress and never dreamed for one moment that the promised land was anywhere but in the future. Today we find ourselves wondering whether perhaps it might not, after all, have been in the past. I hope you can see, friends, why I thought this first chapter was quite interesting. Because he was at a crossroads then in 1952, and I feel like we're also at a crossroads now in 2025. Let's continue. The 19th century firmly believed itself to be a century of nationalism and imperialism. It was the century of Bismarck and McKinley, and it was well aware of it. But in reality, it was internationalist and liberal. Under the aegis of the Occidental white race, let us call it European, a form of world unity had been brought about which was reminiscent of the Roman Empire. As soon as a man left Europe, he entered into a sort of international mercantile republic. The term originates with Eli Halevi. Functioning under the auspices of Great Britain, a republic in which all men of the white race, whatever their nationality, enjoyed the same rights. There were, of course, obstacles erected by nationalism and protectionism, but their influence was limited and always well under control, and the general atmosphere was one of exchange, of almost free exchange at that. When turning backwards, we seek to describe the characteristics of that age, now so completely out of date. We are astonished, above all, at its liberty, freedom of trade, ease of communications, despite the fact that its transport technique must seem infantile compared with the marvellous achievements of our own day, and the freedom with which men could travel in a world which, alas, has disappeared, a world in which men moved around as they pleased, and no one made difficulties for them to surmount, no quotas and no passports. And the solidity and stability of those past times astonish us perhaps even more. Tariffs and commercial agreements, founded on their semi-permanency, provided a basis on a firm on which it was possible to calculate. National credit rested on a firm financial basis, which contemporaries regarded as likely to last forever. Monetary stability, based on gold, made it possible to compare prices over 50 and almost 100 years. And finally, in circumstances in which it was possible to predict the future, there was a remarkable degree of contractual stability. Signatures were still respected. They still are, very often, of course, but in those days, no one thought of congratulating those men who stood by their word as though they were doing something exceptional. And that stability was reflected in the social structure too, because Western man still had deep roots in his world, and that is no longer true today. The peasant was attached to his soil in very much the same way the tree is, and to drag him up by the roots would have had much the same effect. Oswald Spengler also speaks in these terms about the peasant as a kind of plant life or tree. The traditions of the artisan were still alive, and the whole of industry, even mechanized industry, was still imbued with the spirit of craftsmanship, whose origin was fundamentally artisan. The bourgeois himself seemed inseparable from his surroundings, circumscribed perhaps, but also strengthened by his sense of thrift, his love of order amounting almost to a religion. and his determination to pass on to his heirs a constantly improving standard of life. The men of that age firmly believed that the conditions of their life were normal, almost statutory, so to speak, and in accordance with the will of God, they did not doubt for one moment that they would prove anything but permanent. The achievements of science, which were already magnificent, filled them with admiration and confidence, and, as though it were a matter of course, liberty and progress were related in their minds. It simply did not occur to them that there could ever be a halt, even a temporary halt, to the steady march of human progress. Nevertheless, the germs of the coming crisis were already alive and active. Their presence could be seen in the obvious effects of the machine and of industrial concentration, in the existence of a social problem seeking to distinguish the man in the producer, and becoming daily more urgent, and in the rapid growth of the non-European countries, the rivals of the future. But for a long time, no one paid any attention to these things. I can recall a date we all thought fateful at the time, December 31st, 1900, the threshold of a new century. That evening, not without a certain solemnity, we no longer wished each other a happy new year, as we usually did on New Year's Eve, but a happy new century. And the next day, when I went out, I looked with curiosity at the street and at life in general to see whether anything had changed in the night. Nothing had, of course. Everything was in its usual place, and for many years after, that no one thought any more about the possibility. The 19th century was continuing into the 20th. And funny enough, I remember the millennium celebrations around the year 2000. Do you remember that? We kind of lived through a parallel to that, because it felt like the 20th century was continuing in the noughts, didn't it? Under old Tony Blair here, or in George Bush era. Anyway, let's continue. The Great English Review, the 19th century, decided to retain its title with the addition of the words "and after," and that represented a program based on the illusion that was rapidly becoming the past would survive nevertheless. The war, which broke out in 1914, was the first awakening. And by the way, this is written in very clear English, it is not written originally in English by Siegfried. It was translated by a man called Edward Fitzgerald, who's obviously a very good translator because the quality of writing is very good. Don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure that is the same translator who did the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, but I could be wrong about that. Anyway, let's continue. The war, which broke out in 1914, was the first awakening, but people still believe in the possibility of a subsequent return to the status quo ante. As we know, that was the instinctive and naive dream of many, many people. It took the world crisis of 1929 to open the eyes of Western man and make him realize that a page had been turned, that it had already been turned for a long time. We were living in the 20th century and not in the 19th. And it took us 30 years to realize it. If the slightest illusion still remained, the Second World War destroyed it for good and all. We now know that the slightest doubt that a revolution has taken place, a revolution which is far more than merely political, a revolution which quite literally affects the whole of human life. We are now in full sail on the deep waters of the 20th century. And in the melancholy words of Littre, we feel that we are drifting on an illimitable ocean with neither compass nor rudder. In what respect can these two wars, the beginning of such tremendous happenings, be said to change the world, thereby creating that impression of revolution which bears in on our minds from all sides? First of all, there was a revolution in the internal equilibrium of states. The conditions of political authority have been changed. War, having become total, has placed in the hands of governments a plentitude of powers, which is not merely political or military, but economic, social, and technical as well. and it has done so to such an extent that private interests, unable to defend themselves, have become more and more submerged to the collective. That, at least, was the regime imposed on us by the tension and tumult of Basel. But let us not deceive ourselves. The state has no intention of abandoning the powers which have been placed in its hands by exceptional circumstances. It will keep them and seek to consolidate them, didn't it just? And then, in order to justify itself in the eyes of the masses, it will use them to satisfy their material or psychological needs. Panem et circuses, I think bread and circuses, or in the modern terms, ration books, sport and cinemas. And still more, their thirst for equality. The masses, incapable of using their sovereignty, which is tacitly recognized as theirs, have no alternative in an age where large-scale organization has become the sine qua non of highly developed collective life, but to delegate it as a whole into the hands of governments. In this way, it all ends in the dictatorship of one man, or one party, or of a bureaucracy, and at the end of the road, there lies bondage within a framework which we shall continue by habit to refer to as democratic. It would seem that such bondage is suffered or even accepted without complaint. It is that sloth, exhaustion, or moral bankruptcy. Even in our Western societies, the individual is no longer prepared to be left to his own responsibility, to his own devices, and to his own initiative. He asks, even as he demands. He even demands, and he finds it quite natural that the state should take care of his affairs. He places his affairs in the hands of the government, just as a bankrupt places his affairs in the hands of the official receiver. In short, he is no longer free, but we are compelled to ask ourselves whether he really minds, because security has become his prime preoccupation. In this way, society tends to become more egalitarian and more homogeneous, but less liberal. And liberalism itself is henceforth regarded by advanced people, or people so styled, as an outworn doctrine. To defend the individual against the organization is to be reactionary, because the organization itself represents progress. And a word against which there is no appeal, the left. It must be admitted that the conditions of modern industrial production are unfavorable to individual initiative and personal liberty. The artisan epoch, founded on the tool, the simple prolongation of the arm and of the brain, has been succeeded by the mechanical epoch, founded on the machine, which introduced the reign of the engineer. But now, it would seem, we have entered into a new phase in which technique, pure and simple, is giving way in importance to organization and administration. In this administrative age, in which the complex management of affairs necessitates a prior view of the whole and of a deep feeling for the ultimate execution, the big productive unit has become a necessity. The world can no longer advance in extended order. Mass man has replaced the anarchic individual. By compelling the state to control production in a totalitarian fashion, war accelerated an evolution in which technique undoubtedly retained all its importance, but in which organization and administrative qualities became more immediately necessary. In this respect, 1914 and 1939 were decisive stages of development, because they stepped up the process of industrial concentration, and because, in many cases, in the interest of the nation, they imposed the idea of uniformity under state control on large-scale industry. In the course of its development, the big undertaking gradually increases its power. It then naturally becomes political and seeks to lay hold of the state. In order to defend itself, the latter seeks in turn to dominate the former and absorb it. The result, in any case, is that the control of public power is narrowed down without there being any opportunity to curb the state itself. In these circumstances, or the abuse of power, represents a terrible temptation, not so much to the state itself, which is an abstract notion, but to those who effectively exercise public authority. The counterbalancing factors of the liberal epoch are disappearing more and more rapidly in the presence of that formidable mass which towers increasingly over the individual on all sides. The result is that all questions tend to become of an administrative nature, that is to say, indirectly political. And sorry to interrupt him here, but we can see how the political has come to pervade almost every aspect of life by this point in 2025. Individualist societies, which were still almost the rule in the 19th century, are no longer adequate. Today, the state must settle everything by laws and decrees. One might almost say ukases, which are then followed up by innumerable and involved rules and regulations. Health, housing, food, public assistance, social security, the relations between capital and labour, industrial production, all represent problems which are now and forever the affair of the community as a whole. An individual initiative is powerless to resolve them. The hours of our lives, which we must now devote to our dealings with authorities, are becoming more and more numerous. And a great part of the time of manufacturers is taken up by negotiations with officials. The administrative epoch in which we must live make it inevitable. Unless it rationalizes itself, as the mechanical epoch did before it, our choked social organism will invariably be endangered. However, amidst this depressing anonymity, man has undoubtedly gained a great deal. Today he is no longer, as he was under the regime of an aggressive and all-pervading liberalism, merely one of the items in the costing account. The trade union movement, various movements of social reform, and the humane doctrine laid down in the papal De Rerum Novarum have imposed consideration for man on the exigencies of the production. Will the human being, perhaps in the last resort, find the equivalent of progress in this development? What the individual has gained on the one hand, he has lost on the other. Society will soon be menaced by a sort of sclerosis unless it turns back to seek once again the irreplaceable source of its very life in the initiative of the individual. A new equilibrium must be found, and the search for it will be the task of the rising generations. But if the individual is lost in that adventure, then, under a deceptive appearance of technical progress, humanity will have suffered a serious setback. At the same time, there has been a complete change in the equilibrium of the world as a whole. This is an age of rapid communications. In the words of Paul Morand, our century has invented a new vice, that of speed. We can no longer do without it, but in the last resort, its benefits are very doubtful. The aeroplane has abolished distance. What a difference there is between the way we travel and the slowness with which our grandfathers or even our fathers travelled. In 1826, my grandfather took 26 days to go from Marseille to Trebizond by sailing ship. I know the exact time from his diary. Today, we can easily go from Paris to Cairo or from Paris to Istanbul in 24 hours. In 1861, my father took 17 days to get from Le Havre to New York. In 1938, on the Normandy, it took me 4 days and a half for the same journey. And the aeroplane does it in 13 hours. And another, even more extraordinary example. From Barranquilla on the northern coast of Colombia to Bogota, the capital on the plateau of the Andes, about 500 miles inland, was a journey which took about a fortnight only 15 or 20 years ago. First of all, by boat along the Magdalena, and then along the twisting route of a small mountain railway. Quite recently, I made the whole journey in 3.5 hours. I left Barranquilla at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I was in Bogota for lunch. but such rapid journeys are now becoming quite commonplace. Quite recently, I breakfasted in Khartoum and went to bed the same evening in Brussels. I regarded it quite as a matter of course, but I still retain a profound impression of my first air crossing of the Atlantic. I left Orly at 8 o'clock in the evening, and I had supper at Prestwick in Scotland, all in a twilight, which never seemed to end, as though we were chasing the sun. My breakfast the following morning was taken in Iceland, in a fiery and fantastic landscape of reds, yellows, and greens. That evening, at 5 o'clock, we arrived in Newfoundland, after a long flight over the sea studded with icebergs to a barren, icy soil dotted with black fir trees. Then we flew down the American coast over a score of brilliantly lighted towns looking for from above like fairyland. And finally, we touched in Washington at 10 o'clock at night. By comparison with times today, our journey was not in the least remarkable. And even then, the mind experienced no preparation whatever with the change of environment, such as had always been the case formerly during the long hours and the days of the journey. We dropped from the sky and found ourselves suddenly plunged into the atmosphere of a new continent. And the route we followed was not a straight line, but a curved one, the arc of a great circle. Let us abandon Mercator's projection, which is so deceptive in the proportions it gives to the polar territories, and return to the non-Euclidean school of geometry, which we are now perforce beginning to suspect was perhaps more realistic than the other. The consequence of that revolution in speed is the definite end of all insularity in the world. The Bleriot, after Limburg, and after the astonishing performance of aeroplanes since the Second World War, how can anyone speak henceforth of isolation? Today we can get anywhere and get there quickly. And the famous voyage around the world in 80 days makes us smile today because we know it can now be done in as many hours. That is all very true. But can we say that this riot of speed has resulted in better relations between men? We only have to look around us. Political and administrative obstacles have increased. Nations seek to defend themselves by withdrawing behind every possible barrier. Economic liberalism no longer exists. Journeys can be made far more rapidly today than yesterday, but the time gained by technical progress is lost again in an administrative jungle of formalities, customs examinations, visas, and so on. In the upshot, it is not all certain that we have progressed very much. From all this is a change, almost a revolution, has come about in the conceptions of power. The only countries which are in a position to exist as first-class powers today are those which have large territories and a vast population, and which, in addition, are highly organized and exercise control over wide areas of the world. The conditions of modern production demand bigness, for without it, the machine and the mass production could not operate efficiently. Science and technique alone are no longer sufficient, and production cannot be carried on efficiently, except on a scale properly called gigantic. It would seem today that in order to exist as a great power, a country needs 5 or 6 million square miles of territory and a minimum population of 100 million souls. Athens dominated the Mediterranean in her day from a mere strip of territory and with a small elite of citizens. Our 30 or 40 million inhabitants were once enough to ensure us European hegemony. But now quantity is replacing quality, and that is why the United States and the USSR, countries of continental proportions with large populations, are taking over the leadership of the world from that small foreland of Asia, so wonderfully articulated and diversified, but so small, which dominated the world for four centuries. And this is actually something that Alistair Crook has talked about recently, and some of the other analysts on those channels talking about Europe returning to a stop off on the Silk Road, basically, which was, the norm for many centuries before then, after its, 400 years in charge of the world. Those national units, which are not large enough to survive alone in the new era, must now federate. And parallel with the change in the scale of countries and continents goes a shifting of the center of world gravity. Europe ruined, trampled underfoot, and territorially reduced, is no longer in a position to play the role of leader of Western civilization, or to ensure the development of the world as it did for centuries. The center of the world, gravity, has been divided to the advantage of the United States and of a sixth or seventh continent that one might call Eurasian. Funny returning to this now in 2025, because we're seeing all this play out again. The problems of peace and of the reorganization of the world on the morrow of the Second World War were no longer regarded by the victors from the standpoint of Europe, as had previously been the case in all great diplomatic discussions previously. The choice of San Francisco as the venue for the first conference of the United Nations organization was significant. The victors in the first war 30 years ago never dreamt of meeting anywhere but in the old world. It is equally significant that henceforth the headquarters of the new League of Nations should be in the United States and not in Europe, and that Russia has shifted her industrial center from her European provinces to beyond the Urals in the east. The civilized world is growing less and less European and more Asiatic and American. I'm hoping you can see why I'm reading this, by the way. I think it has a lot of resonances for what people are thinking about right now, in the current climate. As a result of this development, the geography of the world roots is no longer the same. A remote spot lost on the edge of the world, like Edmonton in northwest Canada, now finds itself on one of the great intercontinental routes of the globe. In the same way, England, that Ultima Thule of the Middle Ages, beyond which there was nothing but the immense emptiness of the northern seas, became, with the great age of discoveries, the jumping-off ground for maritime exchanges, a sort of bridge between Europe and the new continents, which now took their place in the world relations. Today, the world, and in particular the political world, can hardly be understood except on as a whole on a map of the two hemispheres, and only from this aspect can we see at a glance the new importance of the polar zone, because it is across this zone that the direct continental air communications of the northern hemisphere pass. Thus, the pole itself has come into that sphere which is in dispute between the various imperialist countries. It requires a certain effort of the mind to grasp the fact that the arc of the great circle Chicago-Calcutta passes over the North Pole, and that the nearest non-American country to Canada is Siberia. The wars of the future will be dominated by considerations which past generations could afford to ignore, but which our generation must constantly bear in mind. The world of today no longer resembles the world of yesterday. And how impressive and a little humiliating that is for the European, who has known a different state of affairs. In the years 1898 to 1900, when I was a young man and I travelled around the world, all the doors opened to me because I was a European. I could say with confidence, Civis Romanus sum, and all barriers in my path were lowered. I was conscious of my privilege as a member of the white race and an inhabitant of the leading continent of the world. But how times have changed. Remember now, he's writing in 1952. Today, I have the feeling that I was present at something like the very end of the Roman Empire. And I recall the words of Corneille. Un grand destin finit, un grand destin commence. In the light of such experiences, often painful, we are beginning to grasp the fundamental characteristics of which the 20th century, a century so different from the one which preceded it, and a century in which it took us so long to find our real place. Technical progress has been fabulous. We can marvel at it, so much so that it causes many of us to become even a little lightheaded. We are inclined to believe that we have vanquished the elements, that there is no longer any limit to the powers of man. We have, in fact, put forward the bounds of our knowledge and extended the sphere of our vision well beyond our own universe. But at the same time, the old and apparently firmly founded ideas with which the 19th century lived, for instance, determinism and the idea of natural law, now tend to escape us. The doctrine of determinism, rudimentary as it was, provided us at least with a basis for the moral science of reason. Statistical probability does not offer us the same certitude, whilst the incalculability of atomic progress introduces, under cover of attempting illusion of liberty, an age of uncertainty. And thus we find man's mind profoundly troubled just at the moment when it is seized with enthusiasm at its own astonishing discoveries. The 19th century almost brought about the economic unity of the world. Today, the world tends to break up into great politico-economic units, independent of each other, each powerfully equipped with both militarily and economically, and in fact totalitarian, or tempted by a sort of compulsion to become so. Neither goods nor human beings can any longer circulate freely in the world. The old-style protectionism, which expressed itself simply in customs duties, has only a remote resemblance to the neo-protectionism of our day, based on the quota system and, above all, on exchange regulations. Money is no longer neutral, as it once was, in that system of commercial defence. Today, foreign exchange is parsimoniously distributed by the central banks, and in this way they hold the key to a financial lock which can render the commercial closure practically hermetic. In vain have international conferences adopted resolutions in favour of freer trade and drawn up commercial conventions. Governments have either not ratified them, or when they have, they've taken good care not to implement them. In a world in which all countries desire to industrialise themselves, national protectionism has never been so intransigent as it is today. Still more striking is that form of protectionism which is directed against immigration and even against the simple journeyings of the individual from land to land. Thanks to a complicated network of passports, visas, exchange regulations, and so on, both emigration and immigration have become extremely difficult. Well, some things do change, Siegfried, because that would be considerably altered in the next decade or so after he was writing. It is already hard to travel without the benevolent approval of the state, and quite impossible if the state harbours the slightest objection to the journey. Phileas Fogg set off to travel round the world in 80 days, on the very evening of the day on which he had concluded his wager. Today, and we could do that same journey round the world in less than a week. But how many days would it take us to make all the necessary preparations? And as for setting off before nightfall on the day of the journey was inspired, no one but a lunatic would even think of it. Hercules were not less entangled in the garment of Nessus than we are in our system of passports and visas, exchange regulations, vaccination obligations. We are compelled to throw in our individual lot with the swollen organism of the state, which has too much power over the individual, which is yet too weak to master the immense problems it is called upon to resolve. The state, wrote Valéry, is gigantic, terrible and weak, cyclops of extraordinary power and clumsiness, monstrous progeny of force and law whose contradictions have given it birth. It can live only if a host of little men jerkily set its inert hands and feet into movement, and its great glass eye can distinguish only pennies or billions. The state, the friend of all, is the enemy of each. Fantastic quotation. As you might be able to tell, Siegfried is a bit of a liberal. But that's not to say all the things he's saying is wrong here. In this century of fire and steel, in which many of us have spent 10 years of our lives at war, our moral degeneration is striking. Our fathers could never even have imagined the horrors of which men in our day have been guilty, not in the heat of battle, but systematically and in cold blood. Humanism today appears merely as a rearguard action. The consequences of that upheaval press in on us so rapidly that they seem almost to outstrip the normal pace of time. It is not merely that we are witnessing political or social changes of great moment. We have the feeling that humanity is entering on a new era. The transition from the tool to the machine goes rapidly, but not only in the Occident, but everywhere. The tool was individual, in its way a teacher. The machine is collective by its nature, incompatible with individual initiative. Above all, it has its own rhythm, and it is not the rhythm of man. In consequence, the whole structure of production has been changed. The result has been a revolution in the morale of labor. The work of the artisan or artist in the past was, on the whole, a matter of professional honor. But today, the pages of Pigouai concerning the recaning of chairs and the dignity of labor close to us as they are in time already seem to belong to another age. Nowadays, industrial work in the factories is based, where the employer is concerned, on technique and organization, and where the worker is concerned on speed of movement, alertness, experience, and endurance. In the majority of cases, there can be no question of the dignity of labor or of the old artistic or handicraft spirit, because the work of the individual merges into the common whole in which everything must fit like the movement of a watch. There is no longer any question of one workman distinguishing himself above the rest, working quicker or working better than the rest, because his duty is to remain precisely in his place, like a part in a coordinated mechanical process. The spirit of the working community, of association and cooperation, calls for a new labor morale altogether, one involving many sacrifices, but possibly also full of grandeur, as soon as each is associated with the work of all. Perhaps this morale of the future is fundamentally mystical. As a result, there is a revolution in the social relationships of men amongst themselves. The individualism of the artisan or of the peasant proprietor, so precious from the human point of view, now appears more and more an anachronism. One can no longer produce alone in a society which is grouped around the machine, and in which private ownership finds its proper ambient only with difficulty. Some form of cooperation, whatever it may be, is inevitable. We hope that it will take the individual into proper consideration, but usually it ends up in pure collectivism. Private life itself cannot escape the toils, because the standardization of production logically involves the standardization of consumption. The customer has to be educated in order to adapt his demands to the exigencies of rationalized manufacture, and to such an extent that production for individual requirement, the bespoke trade, becomes impossible, except perhaps for a few millionaires. The domain of the individual shrinks further and further, like the fabulous magic skin. No doubt the average level of material comfort provides in consequence, but from many, many points of view, the individual human being is becoming nothing more than a number in a series. How will the equilibrium of human societies be able to overcome the unprecedented shocks to which it is being subjected? An excessive speed in social transformation threatens to end in catastrophe, but in our days, technique developed more rapidly than the spirit of man. The machinery of production of the 20th century, which is spreading rapidly all over the world, imposes itself on a humanity whose psychology is still largely pre-industrial. In this way, a yawning gap has opened up. There is no need to stress the dangers which arise when new and ultra-mechanized countries come into contact without sufficient preparation with old artisan societies still using the tool almost exclusively instead of the machine. The machine is spreading everywhere today. I have seen textile factories quite as well equipped as our own in the middle of the Andes, amongst the tribes of Indians, reached neither by rail nor road. The transition from the mule to the aeroplane has been made abruptly and not by stages. Nowadays, it is a common sight to see a caravan of camels passed in the desert by motor lorries, whilst overhead the fast plane goes on its way, and below the pipeline carries petrol to the sea. In the southwest of France, the splendid white oxen of Luragai, yoked in pairs, still retain the imperturbable ancient rhythm, but are men capable of the same wisdom? This contact between ways of life which are not, properly speaking, contemporary with each other has all the characteristics of an explosive mixture. Think, for example, of Russia before 1914, with their factories already modern and mechanized, but recruiting her industrial labor force from a countryside still medieval. Think of Mexico, fundamentally native and Indian, still living in a purely artisanal existence, yet situated very close to the most highly industrialized country in the world. There is no social structure, no matter how solid it may be, which can resist such upheavals. The diving bell stifles living organisms under less severe pressures. Man's technical victories are dazzling. The engineer solves all the problems which are set to him. But the businessman, the politician, and above all the moralist, feel themselves at a loss when faced with all the new problems which arise from this progress, which arise more quickly than they can be dealt with. Every new technical advance creates a new social or moral problem. It is as though nature were revenging herself on us by ruthlessly making us pay through the nose for all the advantages of our conquest. And for this reason, the victory over nature, about which we talk so loudly, is neither so effective nor so definitive as we should like to believe. The machine is obedient, but at the same time, as we are witnessing the most tremendous mechanical triumph, civilization is receding and harking back to economic procedures and political morals, which it is no exaggeration to describe as barbarian. The term revolution has been grossly misused. It is used indifferently in all sorts of contexts, but in the case we have been discussing, it still retains all its significance. We are in no doubt whatever that we are witnessing a revolution, not only a political revolution involving sudden changes of government and of personalities, not only of social revolution upsetting the old balance of the classes, but a human revolution which is compelling us to revise all our values, to question even the reasons for our existence, to question the very basis of our morality. When we now think of the years before 1939, we seem to be conjuring up another age, whilst 1914 appears so far away already that even comparisons are becoming difficult, as though it were a society whose ways can no longer serve our intellectual and moral purposes. It is as though they had been a terrible earthquake and we were the survivors emerging from our shelters after the catastrophe. Certain features of the landscape are still recognizable, but it is no longer the same country and one can no longer conduct oneself in the same way as before. It would be folly to suppose that we could go back or to want to restore that which has been and that which is no more. The conquests of the machine are obviously decisive. Man must learn to adapt himself to the new technical, economic, social, and political environment. Such an adaptation demands a revision of our moral ideas, and the position of the individual towards the group must be defined in terms which, if possible, still permit the independence of man's spirit. That is the problem of the Western world today. Now the various countries, which are the mainstays of Western civilization, face this problem, with possibilities rendered very varied by their traditional psychologies. Some of them are tackling the problem with vigour, without looking back. Others are approaching it with some regret for the past, which they still regard as having been of value. Others, again, whose substratum is not only Western, devote themselves to the cause of technical progress with a passion which is to some extent barbarian, which causes doubts to arise as to whether they are really working for the cause of human civilization at all. Perhaps when we have examined some of these different national psychologies, we shall be in a better position to recognize the real nature of the Western world. And that is the rest of the book, him examining the national psychology. So we can start next week with Latin realism. I'm guessing that's Spain and Italy, the Iberian Peninsula and Italy mainly. Then we're going to look at French ingenuity, English tenacity, German discipline, Russian mysticism, which should be interesting, and finally American dynamism. Very interesting book. As you can see, I mean, he's writing in early 50s. He clearly has some economic liberal tendencies, but he can recognize what is happening, you know, or what has happened, and some of its negative consequences as well as its good consequences. All right, join me again tomorrow, where I'll be talking about the British news. Pick up a course at the Academic Agency, trivia and the bestseller there, and most importantly of all, friends, get out. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.